And we are back, Underground Espionage, episode 13. We got a special one. I think 13 is a good number for this one because we are doing our first interview, and that is with Justin Kurzweil of the Hysteria Continues podcast, Hysteria Lives website, Teenage Wasteland slasher book, author, and so much more. We're so excited to have you, Justin. Hello.
Hello, Tara and Mike. Thank you so much for having me on, and what a nice welcome. So, a delight to be on your new show. Just before we started recording, I said I listened to your and enjoyed your Bloody Moon episode very, very much. Very funny and very insightful. So I look forward to... I'm not a huge Jess Franco fan, but after listening to some of your episodes, I think maybe I should delve into it a bit more. Obviously, I know Bloody Moon and what's the other one? The one you mentioned.
Faceless,
yes, those ones I know. Yeah. And a few other bits and pieces, Vampirus, Lesbos, those kind of better known movies. Yeah. But I should delve into it a little bit more, I think.
Yeah, I could see you getting into some of them. Obviously, a lot of them are, you know, Lena Romay running around naked.
And, yeah, it's
and
an array
strange,
of
odd sex scenes.
Violence, strangeness, and nudity. So you get the whole gamut of slow burn versus high action.
Yeah. I would say, you know what I would actually say to do is the Mansion of the Living Dead. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Oh, okay.
Because that's his, the one director and one Spanish director that he genuinely loved was Osorio, the director of the Blind Dead movies. So this is, it's sort of his Blind Dead-ish movie. Now there's still plenty of Lena Romay running around naked. Mm-hmm. And there's also a strange subplot of a woman chained in a hotel. Like, it's, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like an obscured S&M, but it's not quite done right.
It's very strange.
There's never, I don't know if Jess Franco's ever had a bra in
probably not, yes. But yeah. I'll definitely check that out because we've got some friends who come around and watch some stuff on the big screen, and he's always looking for the most obscure and sometimes the worst things. The last time we watched the Mardi Gras Massacre, which isn't Jess Franco.
Oh, but it's, okay, yeah, there yes. you go.
It's kind of, yeah. And Vampire Hookers was another one we watched on the big screen. So yeah, I think some Jess Franco is probably well overdue.
Yeah, but I mean, Bloody Moon does stand on its own in its own world. It's truly just one of the greatest.
Yeah, well, that's actually one we haven't watched on the big screen. So I think I will, yeah. Yeah, let's give that a go.
So good. But
that would be fun to count all the buttons on the outfits in the film. Snaps versus buttons.
Incredible.
The over and under.
But yeah, you know, Justin, when we discovered the Hysteria Continues podcast, really what it was is we're pretty early, definitely not year one, but I would say within the first 3 years we discovered it. And really what we had just watched Rituals. And I was just searching around to see if anyone had done a podcast about Rituals. Mm-hmm. And then I saw you guys did a podcast not only about Rituals and loving it like we did, but then also the love for Friday the 13th Part 5. Now, I know it's, you know, some of the members love it a little more than some of the others, but
he's grown on
we felt a kinship. We're like, these guys are right up our alley. And really, podcasts come and go, and, you know, sometimes just... You stop listening, whatever. Hysteria has been consistently to this day the podcast we continue to listen to all the time. What came first, the book or the podcast? I'm trying to remember the chronology.
Well, it was actually the website that started in 1998, so going all the way back to then. So it was like a couple of years after Scream had come out, and I'd been a big slasher movie fan when I was younger. And because I'm of an age that I was too young to see all the classics on the big screen, like Happy Birthday to Me, Friday the 13th Part 2, all those, The Burning, you know, all those kind of movies. But I did catch up with them on video in the early 80s. And so I did the website first. And then we connected with Joseph through, I don't know if you remember the news groups, like Alt Horror. You know, there used to be alt werewolves, alt kind of sex dwarfs, whatever there was, there would be like a news group for it. So we connected, we were chatting on there, and then for some reason, We came up, I think I kind of thought about doing the podcast. I think it was me, and I sort of thought it would be a fun thing to try because they were relatively new back then. So that was 2011. And actually my book came out in 2010. So it did predate it a little bit. So all around the kind of the same time, really. So it's kind of, I mean, I don't really understand quite how we've managed to last so long. We're kind of functional, dysfunctional kind of family, I kind of guess. And we do have fun. And I think that's one of the things, it's like with you guys as well. Obviously, your banter is very natural. So that kind of really helps with engaging with people with podcasts. Because I think if people are too stiff or too, kind of clipped or whatever, that people have a hard time engaging with that. And I think having that kind of banter and that fun and actually the kind of joy of what you're talking about, that kind of really helps. And so we haven't really lost that. There's been times where we've come close to it, where like Eric's decided to storm off when we covered Axum, one of the worst movies ever made, and he had a complete meltdown over that and decided he was going to leave and do an Inga from Bloody Moon. And then so we've had a few instances like that over the years, but most of it's been fairly smooth sailing. We all kind of get on and tease each other, so yeah, it's still fun to do, which I think is kind of the main thing, isn't it, really?
No, it's huge, and you can tell you guys just have this great, everyone has their own individual
opinions, personalities, taste.
Yeah.
But I think part of the joy of having friends that have similar interests that you do is seeing where those boundaries lie. Mm. So really like testing the limits of your taste by suggesting something you know that's a little out of their comfort zone. Like maybe a little
Nathan
too...
Nathan picks, basically. Yeah.
Well, Nathan
just
picks.
Knowing.
And also I've been really tempted to force an Indian slasher movie on them.
You have to.
Oh.
You absolutely have to. I'm hoping that comes soon. The one you were talking about on a recent episode.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I need. Not only do I need to see it, but you guys have to do that.
It's an experience. Because I don't know if I mentioned, but when I went to South India about the time that movie came out, and it wasn't that movie I saw, but I did see a horror movie at the cinema in South India in the early 2000s. And it was such an experience because it was 2.5 hours long. Half of it was song and dance numbers, and it was so loud you couldn't. Everyone was on their mobile phones, eating lunch. The kids were running around screaming, people chatting, but it was so loud it kind of drowned everything else out. So it was a real experience. So they are. I don't think they're quite like that now. I haven't seen any new. I did look up to see what Indian horror movies were like now, and a lot of them don't have song and dance numbers anymore, which is a shame because this one, as you know, it's the remake, Indian remake of Tamil language. Remake of Urban Legends with a side helping of the Mel Gibson comedy What Women Want. So it's completely insane. But
when you were describing it, I was driving and I literally was just like, what? It just kept, it was like, this can't be real. It just sounds so amazing.
Well, it's kind of, for me, I'm kind of, one of the things that I really like about the podcast, and it's kind of, because we do it for love, we have a Patreon and we make enough money really to get by as far as kind of paying for hosting and all those kind of things. We're not getting rich off it by any stretch. But we could be doing, covering Friday 13th parts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, every week, just redoing, rehashing. And a lot of people have done that before and done it very well. But I kind of, for me, the joy is actually finding interesting films that not many people have seen, and I've kind of really interested in international cinema, you know, sort of finding slash movies from Egypt, like Camp, from Indonesia, from Cambodia, all these kind of things that just don't really get seen or talked about outside of their own countries. And for me, it's much more interesting looking into that or looking into the history of obscure slash movies from the early 1980s, North American ones. And finding out the stories behind them, how the newspapers, how they were reviewed at the time, kind of any backstories. I found like this great background story on the director of Honeymoon Horror, and he was like a gay man with three poodles who was very eccentric, and it just wasn't what I was expecting. But like those kind of things, I think, are much more interesting for me than rehashing all the kind of big tentpole franchise movies. But for us, when we do cover those, and if we cover a Bollywood or an Indian slash movie, our listenership will dive quite considerably. But for that, for us, it doesn't really matter. We're not trying to hit targets or anything like that. So we do what we kind of want. You know, obviously with an eye on what other people want to listen to, but for us, it's, I think it's interesting talking about things a bit more obscure. And like you say, your interest in things, you know, that's kind of underneath the things that aren't on the surface. And for me, I just find that just more interesting, really, because otherwise it's just rehashing the same old thing about the big Texas Chainsaw Massacre or whatever. So many people, good people have written about them. It doesn't need redoing all the time.
Yeah, I get so excited when there's an episode on a movie I haven't seen or heard of, and I actually always we always listen to them. I don't mind spoilers a lot of times. It's sort of, Tara always says it relaxes her, honestly, if she just
yeah, I can sip it. That's why I like the Demons 1, Demons 2, because I know everybody's gonna die, so I can just kind of like sit back and relax and let it happen. So I feel like calm when I know what's gonna go down.
Yeah, it doesn't really bother me. So we enjoy like listening to an episode on a movie we haven't seen, then we'll watch the movie, then go back and listen to it again. And the more obscure, the better. Exactly. You know, it's always fun to talk about the big boys, but you know, the more obscure stuff is to me more interesting. And the thing with podcasts in general is once you get in a rhythm of one, it makes no difference to me. A new episode comes out, I'm hitting play because I want to hear you guys talk or whatever other podcast we all listen to. I just want to hear the episode. I don't even, it almost doesn't matter to me what you know, the topic is. It's like, oh, I'm going to hear you and Eric make fun of each other. And, you know, we're going to, you know, hear Nathan not have any background and et cetera. You know, it's the best. So
they're same jokes.
And their accents, I'm from Kentucky, which is near Tennessee and near the South. So they relax me. Like, I feel like their cousins or something.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
I appreciate the cadence.
So let's go back. Let's go back. When did you start getting into movies? When did you start getting into slashers? How did it all happen? I mean, and of course, obviously, you know, being into a shared love of a lot of bands that, you know, all three of us here love, Sisters of Mercy, Susie and the Banshees, etc. Did getting into music and movies all happen around the same time? Give us your personal history with all this stuff.
Well, I was born in 1969, so I kind of grew up as a young kid in the 70s, and then kind of not coming of age, but early teenagers in the early 1980s. So I think I was always a kind of a creepy kid in so much that I was interested in horror from a very early age. And I would go into our local library and find books on horror movies. And they wouldn't be particularly explicit, but they would just be like, you know, the kind of these kind of big kind of encyclopedias of horror and things like that. So I'd be fascinated by them. And so I'd try and watch horror. I'd love Scooby-Doo and all these kind of things. So I think there was something kind of hardwired almost for my love of horror. So when I was growing up in the kind of late 70s and early 80s, I would see, as I mentioned, I was on the way to school. I can remember distinctly seeing the posters outside cinema for, especially the double bill, The Amityville Horror and Dressed to Kill was up forever. It seemed like years it was outside cinema. Of course, it wasn't. But I remember seeing Friday the 13th Part 2, Happy Birthday to Me, Zombie Flesh Eaters, all these posters out of cinema. And of course, there was no way I could get to see them because the ratings were so different in the UK. It was they were X-rated back then, which meant no one under 18 could go in. So you couldn't, even with an adult, a guardian, you couldn't go and see an 18-rated movie.
Wow.
So, and this is kind of pre-video as well. So the only way I could see stuff would be on TV. And so the BBC used to run Friday night double bills. And they would start with something old and creaky like the Jack Tornier's Night of the Demon, or some film about witches, or a Hammer film, an old 1950s black and white movie. And after that, it would be kind of an amicus movie like The Beast Must Die. But sometimes they would put on some very strange kind of obscure movies. Like sometimes they put on this kind of, I remember seeing this Filipino horror movie where they use real cadavers. And I remember seeing it at the age of 11 or 12, I was thinking, wow, that's really freaky. Even then I could tell it was using real cadavers, and somebody had just booked it on the BBC without even checking, probably. Wow. And the story I told on the podcast, I won't go into it extreme detail now, but of course when they accidentally showed Black Christmas uncensored for the bad language, and it was the first time the C word had ever been uttered on the BBC in about 1982.
Wow.
So I kind of, and then I would, in the advent of video, and I was just too young to catch the Video Nasties. They came out, obviously, I'm sure your listeners, and you'll know a little bit, or you might know a lot about the Video Nasties, because that was the kind of a furore, kind of sort of a press hysteria and political hysteria around violence on video, because the UK had very tightly controlled censorship. With video, there was no classifications. So a lot of movies released to video uncut, which was completely unknown of in the UK. So there was this kind of wilderness time, for a couple of years where films were released. The media and politicians got, and kind of moral crusaders got hold of them. And they would show the worst bits of these so-called video Nazis in Parliament, and so they were trying to get them banned. And of course, a lot of them did get taken off the shelves. And so, by the time I was old enough to look anywhere near 16 or 18, most of those movies are gone from the video shelves. But there would be some films like Friday the 13th, Rosemary's Killer, aka The Prowler, those kind of movies, House on Sorority Row, which is called House of Evil in the UK, that I could rent and get away with. And so that was kind of my introduction. But a lot of the films, I remember watching, like Euro Horror, the Living Dead at Manchester Morgue, the Jorge Grau movie, and it was cut so much that had no blood in it at all. I remember thinking, what was the fuss all about? Because there's nothing left. So there's lots of Burial Ground was released. I cut on video, and it was about 40 minutes long because so I was thinking, what is all the fuss about? So it wasn't until a little bit later that some friends, when I was about 17 or 18, there was a big market for basically bootleg videos, and people would be trading Maniac and Cannibal Ferox and all these kind of movies, which could potentially land you in jail. So there was a kind of sense of danger around that. At the time, so I did get to see some of the more extreme movies, Necromantic, you know, Cannibal Ferox, the Cannibal films, which I don't watch any of those movies now anyway because of the animal violence, but I've seen them once, and each to their own. But I've kind of it's funny, as I've got older, I've kind of mellowed as far as my enjoyment of extreme movie watching, like Necromantic 1 and 2, those kind of, you know, violent shit, those kind of movies. I don't find much pleasure in watching them now, particularly. So I've kind of regressed or progressed, perhaps, back to my kind of childhood. So the more of the, you know, a bad movie, an Italian giallo with bad dubbing, English dubbing, makes my heart sing. You know, that's kind of where,
oh, yeah,
you know, where I'm at. Having said that, I mean, I could watch, I watched a very violent giallo recently, which is quite well done. So I'm not, I don't mind them, but
of course,
if I'm going to watch a movie with friends, I'm going to be watching Mardi Gras Massacre and watching, you know, massive hearts being cut out of rubber torsos. You know, that's kind of where my joy comes from these days.
Oh, no, definitely. And I think on the episode of Hysteria that I was on, the Too Beautiful to Die episode, we discussed that nowadays I get more excitement out of the non-slashing part a lot of times. You know, the hour-long part of Final Exam where there's no kills is almost my favorite part of that movie, you know.
Just the part where you question, like, maybe this isn't what I thought it was.
Yeah.
Is anything ever actually going to happen? We're going to water ski. Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, or the games. We've been, just to get in the zone to talk to you, we've just been throwing out a lot of the classic slashers, and you know, the Burning and Sleepaway Camp have seemingly full-length baseball games. Happy Birthday to Me as the soccer game. You know, so I love, like, those.
Yeah,
are almost,
like,
my
I want a medley
part
of slasher, like, teenage, like, sport events. You know, just cut to teenage sport events.
We've got graduation day. You've got the amalgamation of the two, haven't you? Sort of Death by Javelin, and you know. Or Fatal Games.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then you have the great scene with the band Felony, where there's some people are roller skating, but then other people are walking in the circle.
Yeah.
And then that song plays like 100 times.
Well, there's teen games, then there's Battle of the Band scenes too. Yep.
Like
in Neon Maniacs, Battle of the Band. Like, there's so many band scenes that would also be fantastic to
well,
do.
I did. You may have heard the episode, but I did do a compilation of songs from Slash Move School Saturday Night Cleaver. Years ago, so which, you know, that it's, there's something I don't know, I think it's a mixture of getting older and also the world being quite shit at the moment in a lot of ways. Actually, I know quite a few people that I'm kind of know within who genre critics and people like that, you know, people like that say that they actually, there's something going back and watching an old slasher movie that is quite joyous, and it's the irony, you're talking about slashing up teenagers, it shouldn't be, but like you say, it's all the other things that come with it, the kind of the music, the ambiance, the kind of nostalgia to it, and I think it's kind of a lot of the time with horror movies, they lose their power to shock. What may have shocked an audience back then, it's campy now. Like the Demons movies, I remember when Demons came out, the first one, there was a real sense of it being quite demonic and scary. And I love that movie. I think it's great. But there is, and especially with Demons 2, there's definitely a campiness to it, which is very enjoyable. Mm. It's not scary. Although, strangely, say with Demons 2, where they used Dead Can Dance and all the kind of the gothic stuff in the second one, actually had some incredibly powerful kind of haunting moments with like the demons running up with the lit eyes, which taken in isolation is kind of actually pretty spooky. But when you've got a rubber demon baby flying through the air, it less so. It kind of only reminds me of Susan the Banshees were invited to be in The Howling 2, in that scene in the club with Christopher Lee with his new wave glasses, and the which is a terrible... I mean, I love The Howling 2, it's terrible, but it's very fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, even they turned that down.
They played that, so I don't know if you're familiar with the station USA here, but...
The TV
they played
station.
Howling 2 constantly.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So as a teen, like, I wanted a television so that I could stay up late, watch USA Up All Night, see Gilbert Gottfried. Howling 2 played constantly. Yeah. American Werewolf in
great one.
Paris.
In London. Paris. Both. Paris would have been more modern. Well, I guess maybe
the more modern
90s,
one is what they played. Yeah. So it was just that was like the ultimate joy, was staying home alone and trying to like not let anybody know that you're, you know, in your bedroom watching Motel Hell at 3 a.m, you know. It was great.
One thing I actually did want to ask you, because it's one thing I've always been confused about with the Video Nasties, is, you know, we do enjoy a lot of those 60s and 70s Hammer, especially the a little more off the beaten path ones, you know, and it seems like those movies have a lot of violence and a lot of sex, and so I was curious as to, were those viewed as something different than the Video Nasties? Did it have to do with that they were supernatural and wasn't is part of the Video Nasties that it could conceivably happen? I've always been confused about the how those were viewed.
Well, I think the Hammer won an award from the Queen at one point, or some kind of royal degree. So the Hammer films in the 50s and early 60s were seen as very prestigious for the British film industry to some degree, sort of. I think there's something to say for you know, what age you are, that like I'm kind of too young, bizarrely, for the Hammer films. I enjoyed them when I was growing up, but I don't tend to watch them very much now. And I think people are 10 years older than me, they love the Hammer movies. But seeing the evolution of Hammer into Amicus, and you saw that Hammer tried to sex things up with like Dracula 1972 AD, and you saw all of the kind of more explicit violence and the nudity sort of becoming more pronounced, but there was still the censorship. You wouldn't get away with anything too much. So even with those films, they had splattering of violence. They had more erotica, I kind of guess, than out and out, or sort of some nudity, but out and out sexual content. And funny enough, most of the Video Nasties were not, it was not really anything to do with sex. There were kind of pornos and stuff released in the UK, Electric Blue and all those kind of movies kind of came out around that time. But it was the violence for some reason. I'm not sure what it was, but it was something, because we have like, you have the MPAA in the United States, and then the UK is the BBFC, is the British Board of Film Classification, I like to call themselves, or censorship, we would call it. And Famously, like Maniac, the Joe Spinell Maniac film was banned and escorted out of the country by the police, because they had a certain criteria. There was things that you couldn't have blood on breasts, for one thing. They saw it was a rape trigger. So there was a lot of things going on there that they were very prescriptive about what you could have and what you couldn't have. And so when you had these unregulated movies coming in, which I would say, bar possibly a few of them, they're not that troubling today. You know, I rewatched Dawn of the Mummy. I just got the new Treasured Films uncut presentation. And it wasn't banned as a video nasty, but I think it was certainly on one of the other lists. There were sections one, section two, section three. But it's kind of like to think that anyone would have got hot under the collar with that movie back then. But they did. And of course, the other thing was, as I mentioned, there was the Mary Whitehouse. I don't know if you've heard of her. She was like a Christian crusader.
Yeah.
So she had her fellowship who was against. They basically, at one point, they were trying to ban all videos, the adult videos, as in anything that would go above a 15 certificate for home entertainment. So you couldn't have any movie. You know, you couldn't have The Godfather, you couldn't have anything. They were trying to ban everything that would be above what would be suitable for children on home video, in case a child got to see it. And that was their real bugbear, was children seeing these movies. There's a great book called Seduction of the Gullible, which looks into this. And there was all the things, and I know you had it in the States as well. People said, I saw zombie flesh eaters, and then I went out and bit off a granny's tits. You know, it was that kind of thing, you know. There was a big thing, that the idea that children would be corrupted by these movies. And it was, it all goes back to the EC comics in the United States, similar moral panics. But the British seem to have something about them. It's kind of a dual thing, where the British are very kind of, they love naughty seaside saucy postcards and Benny Hill, you know, Lovely's Been Chased By.
Yeah, Benny Hill.
All of those kind of things. But when it gets to beyond a certain point, you also have this morality police and this kind of weird attitude to sex and violence. And I think there's also something about very much being in tightly control. And so when there was this kind of Wild West of video, the politicians and the moral guardians and the newspapers didn't like it. I mean, funnily enough, the newspapers, if you look back far enough, they're all reviewing these video nasties. They're all carrying adverts for them. I mean, it's not going to be a surprise to anyone that the press is often corrupt and, you know.
Well, they were just, you know, really concerned that you're going to see this as a young kid and grow up and start a podcast. And also, too, it always, the funniest thing is, what better advertisement for a movie like Maniac as a 13-year-old? You hear this movie was escorted out of the. I am going to do anything.
How can I find it?
You know, like, what better advertisement?
I was going to say, they did that with Make Them Die Slowly, didn't they? Cannibal Ferox, when they played in the Grindhouse in New York, it said banned in 39 countries. So, and on the video box as well. So again, as they say, the old adage, there's no such thing as bad publicity. And quite often, when I was doing some research into Silent Night, Deadly Night, and like how they had all the protests outside, and sometimes that people would organise protests. They did, famously, I think it was the Roberta Finlay, Michael Finlay movie Snuff, which was the Charles Manson-style Argentinian movie. They tacked on a fake snuff bit at the end. And they organised a protest outside themselves. So like you say, no, there's no such thing as bad publicity until they start burning your videos and burying them in the ground like they did in the United Kingdom. And then that pushes it a bit too far. And you get people going to prison, because the guy who released Nightmares and Damaged Brain, a.k.a. Nightmare, a Scavolini film in the UK, went to prison for distributing a movie that wasn't certificated. So, you know.
And nearly Cannibal Holocaust.
Yes. Well, in that also, I think in, funnily enough, in Italy, there was kind of like Lucio Fulci, when he had to go to court to prove that the dogs in A Lizard in a Woman's Skin weren't real dogs. They were kind of dissected. And I know Ruggero Deodato had to prove that the cast was alive on Cannibal Holocaust. You kind of think the Italian film industry censorship's completely out the window, but in fact, actually, it was quite strict up until, you know, a certain period of time.
Well, I could only think of Father Ted. Are you familiar with this show?
Yes.
When they're protesting and they're like, down with this sort of thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's very good. It's very good. Kind of pastiche on all of that kind of the thing. I mean, it is kind of now it's kind of strange because you don't have people out with placards. Well, you do outside Tesla, perhaps. But a lot of the activism now is kind of through social media and kind of media manipulation and, you know, kind of other podcasts that have got everything is very kind of split into two camps now. And I do kind of wonder what the future, I think it's, you know, the internet has been so freeing in a lot of ways. The fact is you can, you know, back in the day, if I want to see a movie, you know, it was either at the cinema or on video. And if it was like Maniac and it was escorted out of the country, I could possibly get an Nth Generation video that had been recorded from one VCR to another, barely be able to watch it. But now you can find pretty much anything on the internet. It's a great leveler in a lot of ways. So it'd be very difficult to put the genie back in the box, I think.
Yeah, it's so crazy. I mean, you know, it's funny, I know you're not the biggest fan, but speaking of something like Cannibal Holocaust, mm-hmm. that was one in particular where in the 90s, I'd wanted to see it, I'd heard about it, finally found the only way you could get it was this VHS that was dubbed off a Japanese Laserdisc. And in the middle had the blue, you know, when you had to flip the Laserdisc.
Well, that's what El Topo was like and all of the...
So many.
All of those, you had to see them off Japanese Laserdisc.
Just finding those and trying to discover them. And now you can just literally, you know, turn on the TV and with however many apps there are, you can pretty much watch anything. So it is interesting. And I do wonder if people will have the same relationships to movies that, say, we all do, where, you know, you had X amount of VHS and you rewatched the ones that you had. And it might not always be the quote unquote best ones, but, oh, I owned Friday the 13th 6, you know, but I didn't own the others. So that was the one I watched all the time or whatever the case may be.
And you recorded it off television and you remember the commercials as they come up.
Yeah. So the way we relate to a lot of these older movies, especially when we all came up, I just wonder what the next generation do. Are they going to have that same, they watch this movie 100 times and get into that nuance? Yeah. I just don't know.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I know even with myself, I think with the kind of modern technology, and I find myself, I have to go and put my phone, if I'm watching a movie, I have to go and put my phone somewhere else. Because I'm constantly thinking, oh, what's, you know, and look, and I'm thinking, no, I need to stop doing that. And they sort of say now with kind of younger people that the whole TikTok generation and stuff, people, you know, they're not interested necessarily in films that are kind of slow burns. Although having said that, I mean, there are, you know, paradoxically, there are films like Skinner Inc. and like films like that that have done, you know, have found an audience. It's not necessarily true to completely. And of course, people aren't all the same. But I think... there's so much out there that sometimes it used to be if you went into a video store, I'm sure you went into video stores and you'd see and you'd be looking and thinking, oh, what shall I rent today? And looking at the boxes. But now, which is was a much more immersive experience, much richer experience than flicking through Amazon Prime or Netflix. And the amount of time you can just endlessly scroll thinking, oh, I don't, you know. So it's the same with music, I kind of guess, in a lot of ways with like LPs, how they, you know, getting LPs and actually being a kind of a ceremony almost, so getting it out, putting it on the record player, flipping it over. Whereas now everything's streaming and you kind of end up listening to probably, when I'm streaming stuff, I tend to listen to the same stuff over and over again. Whereas in my record collection, I kind of go in and flip through. So I think, I don't know. I mean, I think horror is always going to be there. You know, there's always going to be there, whether or not, you know, what horror means, because horror always reflects our current situation, doesn't it? I mean, you look back at, you know, the kind of UFO panic and the Soviet panic in the 1950s, the body horror of the 70s, all those kind of things you can argue have some fit in with some socioeconomic or whatever kind of going on or cultural thing at the time. And even at the time might not know that. And of course, with the slasher movies of the early 80s, there's very much this idea of them being... paradoxically both very conservative and very anti that you had this idea of have sex and die being sort of like quite a regressive kind of attitude in the slasher movies, but also showing nudity and violence. And so it's an interesting that kind of thing. So I think going forward with the movies, you know, what are popular horror movies now? And funnily enough, I was talking to an old college friend of mine who runs a company called Fab Press,
Harvey,
and it's actually his his wife, girlfriend at the time at college, she's half Italian, and we used to go around and watch Lucio Fulci movies and Italian movies in the early 90s, which was kind of my introduction to them. And I said to him, how long is this going to last, this kind of fascination with 70s and 80s movies? Because it seems to be going on for so long now. And of course, you had the Stranger Things phenomenon, and now you've got the Fear Street on Netflix, a prom queen coming up, and all these movies. And you've got these younger people who have a fascination with those 80s movies. But of course, for people like myself, and you know, for whenever you grew up, you kind of, you know, it's very easy to look back in rose-tinted glasses and look at the 80s all being about big hair and rah-rah skirts and bangles and, like, you know, that kind of thing. Or the 90s all about being grunge and, you know. But when you actually lived through it, a lot of it was just tedium of waiting for, you know. And, fear of nuclear war or whatever. So
I mean, we grew up in the 80s, so, that was definitely a thing. It is funny with the sex and death. Oh, you killed, you get slashed. I guess maybe just because I was young watching these, it never hit me that that's what someone would think. For me, it was just like, oh, cool, I get to see like this chick, and I get to see a kill. Like, it never,
these
like
are the
it never.
People I'd rather watch.
Yeah. So I was always just like, I like it both.
That's the right way of looking at it, and that's how they were made. They weren't made as this morality play at all. It was what was forced upon them by critics afterwards. Because the critics, I mean, I talked about this a lot with, like, the looking at the reviews from early 80s slasher movies in American press. I mean, they see quite often, they say sometimes that this is one step above child pornography. For reviews of, they call something like Sleepaway Camp one step above child pornography, or they call, they're so kind of extreme with their language about these movies, berating women for being in them, berating men for being in them, berating people for watching them, taking the piss out of the audiences, reviewing the audiences. That is kind of very kind of odd. You don't see that now, do you? There's a respect for horror, I think, now that there wasn't back then.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely.
Well, there was that position of, like, you can't be an intellectual and be engaged by horror or even perversity, which I think now that people can be more open and honest, we've kind of rejected that model of thought.
Well, and just the way a lot of these companies, too, are treating these movies, from slashers to pornography. I mean, Vinegar Syndrome doing both, and from Vinegar Syndrome to Arrow to Umbrella to all these companies who are really treating these movies like the way we think of them, you know, giving, you know, these nice restorations.
Well, but
these things,
curating,
and it makes it,
is so
and curating
important
them,
because there's so much information. Like, you know, we talk about how it must be overwhelming for young people or people who are just getting into an interest to find what they want to get into, because there's so much information, you know, but at the same time, there's so much information until there's nothing, you know? So if we didn't have people putting these reissues out, what would happen, you know? Because if they weren't restored, then everybody's old VHS copy is going to be, you know, dead soon and unwatchable. You know, half the things are already so dark.
Well, I mean, it's amazing what, like, Vinegar Syndrome, people like that do, especially with the Italian releases, which it's interesting that when I've been to Italy a few times and I've spoken to Italian people, and there's a young Italian couple in their late 20s, maybe living next door to us about 5 years ago, and I mentioned, like, Dario Argento, Mario Bava, those kind of people, and they were going, oh yes, trash movies. They called them trash movies. Now, I call, you know, my website, I kind of slash a trash with panache. I don't think trash is necessarily a bad word.
Of course.
But it's kind of, and there is obviously a cult around horror movies and erotica from Italy, amongst certain people in Italy, but didn't feel like there was a kind of celebration of it in the wider context now, or back when I was in Italy, and the same in Spain where I live now. There's you know, if you say to someone about Paul Naschy, they won't know who you're talking about. A friend of mine who's a French genre critic went into I think it was a film history department or whatever. It was kind of a big film preservation place in Madrid. And he said, what have you got on Paul Naschy? And they said, oh, we don't deal with those films. So there is still a snobbery around it in Europe, bizarrely. Mm-hmm. Whereas not necessarily in the UK. I don't think that's necessarily the case. In the UK, I think there's kind of a proud heritage of Hammer and Amicus. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. it's how people deal with it, which is why without Vinegar Syndrome, restoring these movies, a lot of them, of course, a lot of them were made with mafia money in Italy. And the rights were very kind of muddled about who owned what. So that's part of the reason why a lot of these movies have disappeared or have not been able to be released. So Vinegar Syndrome and some of these other boutique labels are really doing an amazing work actually getting the rights to some of these movies and getting them out there, which I think is, you know, fantastic for the Italian audiences as well, you know, so.
It's amazing, you know, a lot of these countries, you know, kind of look away from some of that stuff, but I did hear that France is making Orgroff the Mad Mutilator the national movie. it's going to be enshrined into immortality.
They're taking it to the Louvre.
Yeah. It's going to be right next to the Nike, Mona Lisa.
Playing all the time.
I've got a feeling they'll probably enshrine it in concrete and sink it in the Seine. But
absolute shout out to Matt Minner. He is actually is our oldest friend.
Yes. Okay.
I met Matt literally my first day in college in the 90s.
Wow.
And we've been friends ever since. So that episode, anyone listening, people are listening are definitely familiar with Matt. You have to go listen to that episode. It's so great. And I, when he told me that that's what he was going to do, he's like, I don't know how this is going to go. so that is definitely a shining episode, I think.
Honest, I say it quite often when I review films, there's nothing, and watch films, there's nothing worse for a film to be than if it's boring, that's the worst thing it can be.
Yep.
Yes.
But yeah, no, the episode with Matt was great, and it was a great introduction. I mean, Orgroff was a fun film. I mean, it's kind of, you know, arguably a little more than a home movie, but I appreciated seeing it. And there's a lot of much more inventiveness going on in the 99% of modern kind of corporate horror. So,
well, yeah, and that's something that we love about that style of movies. I mean, we are big Nathan Pick fans, yes, well. And for anyone listening who hasn't checked out Hysteria Continues, first of all, that's insane. Obviously,
you
need to
check it out.
And so Nathan Picks being shot on video, some would say Z-grade movies. You know, Blood Lake is a favorite of ours.
Blood Lake, yes.
And a favorite of Nathan's.
Something with a singular vision, but not necessarily a coherent plot.
And what we really appreciate is that taking something seriously. I mean, I know on the Patreon you guys did Feeders recently, a movie we love, and we love the Polonia brothers.
Yes.
And what we love about the Polonia brothers is they're having fun, but it's not a joke. They're sincerely making this movie with the means that they have. They understand they're not making Titanic, but they are also not winking like, oh, isn't this so, you know, they it's treated in a way that is sincere. That's something we love about the Polonias. It's something we love about that type of shot on video where there's fun and they know what they're doing, but it's also not, you know, meta commentating.
So
on
it's
this
not and, trauma. And, I mean, that's the thing for me.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Which we're not giant fans of.
Yeah. I feel like trauma is something that maybe you,
it's a gateway.
Start, yeah, it's a gateway to something else, and it's just that shock of, like, I can't believe somebody made this. You know, and once you get past, I can't believe somebody made this, you're like, I don't know why they made this. But the Polonia brothers, like, you don't wonder why. You know they're compelled to make it because they love it.
Compelled to pull up those tube socks.
Yeah, they're get that mustache greased up. Get them tube socks up because we're going to go. But it's out of joy and passion and love. And I think that that's so inspiring to anybody who could be an artist or a creator.
Absolutely.
You just feed on that, you know?
I think it reminds me, there's a podcast called The Chart Show, which is a where if you've heard of a show called Top of the Pops, which was like the BBC chart show, ran from the 50s through to the early 2000s. And they dissect an episode and they look at the history. But one of the things they say, that although they do it with humour, they say, although we may, you know, take the piss or the mickey out of some of the artists, we realise that you've got on Top of the Pops and made a pop song and we haven't. So I think that's the other thing with something like the Polonia Brothers or anyone who's made a movie, they've made it, you know, they've genuinely made a film that they love. And I agree that sincerity is much harder to fake than hamming it up and being very campy. Yeah. And actually, some of the I love like something like Eyeball, like Umberto Lenzi's Eyeball, is incredible. I think it's hilarious. I think it's such a fun movie, and it's the dubbing is so bad but fun. It adds everything, but it's made with sincerity, and it's kind of. And sometimes I feel not bad, sort of taking the mickey out of movies, because it's never quite that. I always, when I watch the movie, I want to feel the joy of a good bad movie. I don't want to be mean about the movie. I don't take pleasure in being mean about movies. But sometimes if I hear a really bad line reading in a movie, it just gives me a sense. I just love, it gives me a tingle.
Yes.
And I don't know what it is about it. And I'd much rather watch a good, fun, bad movie than a boring, art house pick. Although I do love some art house picks, but I'd rather watch.
Sure, of course, yeah.
That. So, and also I get enjoyment out of the thriller aspects of these movies as well, and the horror aspects of them. So, but again, I think when something's made of sincerity, you know, don't you? And when I think some of the more modern movies, and I've kind of grown to appreciate the 90s movies, which I think when I was growing up, I was not really that into them, and I thought, oh, there's such a pale imitation of 80s movies, and everyone's just pouting, and it's very, everything's so uniform, and But I've kind of grown to appreciate them more now. So, I mean, tastes do change. But, I think it's... sorry, I'm being distracted by my little white dog.
It's okay. Justin has an incredible,
cute,
incredible dog on his lap.
Still know what you did last summer. Yeah. They're fantastic.
Yes.
Like, I don't... Like, at the time, I do remember kind of scoffing at them and thinking,
It was trendy horror. Trendy horror was the term that was being bandied about at the time after Scream, which... I couldn't really understand, because all horror is trendy. If you're looking at Dracula AD 1972, you can't find a trendier movie from 1971, even trying to be trendy.
Right.
A lot of these horror movies, all horror movies are trendy at the time they're made. I mean, the whole point of movies is to make money and appeal to an audience. So I didn't really understand that. And also, I still know what you did last summer. I think... Yeah, the karaoke scene in that is one of the best scenes in any slash movie ever made.
No question.
Hands
is incredible.
Down.
And speaking of the changing of opinions or the way you feel about movies, something that you've talked about a lot, where, you started the website in 98. You were coming from more of, if it's not Halloween, if it's not Friday the 13th, it's not, I'm not really, but now... As years go on, even just looking through your book before, preparing for this episode, there's definitely some movies that you have strong negative opinions on that I know that you've turned around on.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, like, having all this stuff documented for so long, do you think about going back and changing these things? Do you keep them for posterity and update them? How do you deal with that, having so much content out there since the 90s?
It's very difficult, because I know the reason I started the website was partly because I was doing, I went to do a master's degree in IT by mistake. And when I say by mistake, I went to art college I got a degree in art, and then there was an arts conversion course, and I wanted to do web design. This was in 97, 98. And then I kind of had the most bizarre kind of entrance exam, and it was, you had to go through and do it, say if something was right or wrong according to some questions about tuberculosis in black communities in San Francisco in the 1960s. It was this bizarre thing, but it was supposed to show the logic that you're given information, and I kind of aced it. I got 85%, and I thought, how did I do that? And I said, I don't, and they said, well, you clearly have this really good brain for this thing. I thought, okay. So I started this, took a loan out. And then when I started talking about databases and SQL and things like that, I thought, what the fuck have I done? I've got an art brain, not a kind of, a science brain or a mathematical brain at all. And so I thought, actually, what I'll do is I'll just teach myself web design. Because they're not teaching me that here. So I thought, what would be the best thing to do is actually do a website teaching myself web design, doing something that I, you know, I loved. So that's why the reason I set up the site, and it kind of grew from there. But back then, it looks like most of the earliest reviews looked like and written by an illiterate chimp. The worst spelling and punctuation, so they are quite embarrassing, because I know sometimes someone will go and think, oh, just see what he thinks about Deep Red, and I would have written that 25 yeah. years ago, and it's just completely incoherent. So I have been going back some movies. I've just done a big deep dive on Andrew Davis's The Final Terror, the one with Rachel, what's her name, Daryl Hannah and Adrian Smed. And so it's a film that actually, funny enough, I haven't done a huge, you know, 180 degree turn on it. It's kind of, it's a film I like a little bit more, but I still think it's not. And partly the reason actually looking into it was the realizing that they actually made the wrong movie. They wanted Samuel Zarkov wanted to make a teen slasher movie, and they didn't really make a teen slasher movie, so they had to go in and re-edit it and add extra murders. So it doesn't quite work. It looks beautiful. But it's not a great movie. But I've done, deep diving into, you know, all the background, where it was made, what year it was made, and things like that. Which kind of, so I feel like going back and looking at these movies, it kind of gives a, you know, gives me an opportunity to do that. But it's an awful, huge amount of work, and I've kind of, I'm at the proposal stage at the moment on a new book. When we're talking about obscure movies, this is actually on mainstream from hell thrillers from the 80s and 90s.
Excellent.
Because I thought, actually, I looked at it, there is no books on this huge genre, thriller genre, from Fatal Attraction through to The X, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Single White Female, all these movies. There's nothing on them at all, the from hell genre. So I did a commentary recently for the Mikey, the 1992 Kid from Hell movie, with Amanda Reyes recently. And I actually thought, and then I watched that and I was thinking, wow, this is really where it takes the from hell concept and takes it into the slasher movie. And I thought it would be really fun to go back and look at those. So that's what I'm kind of doing at the moment. So this kid's running up the road outside. In case of the screaming coming from Kurzweil Towers, I haven't got anyone in the basement. But so I might need to sort of, if that gets accepted as a proposal, I might need to scale back a little bit on the reviews on Hysteria Lives, just to work on that. But yeah, I've just been finding out today. I didn't realise I did a sample review of Single White Female, and I find it was great information, including Jennifer Jason Leigh. In the famous blowjob scene in Single White Female, if you remember it, she had a stunt dildo, and she used to spray it with menthol. sort of method acting. She covered a whole dressing room in pictures of her co-star, because the one she's obsessed with. So it was like fun stuff like that. It's the kind of thing for me.
Are you sure that's not what Eric does with pictures of you?
He probably does. Yes. But again, for me, and this is what come back to, because I think one of the things that's changed recently in genre criticism in the last 10 years is there's been much more of a move to academia, much more of a move to kind of people. I would argue there's some great people. Like Amanda Reyes is one of my favourite people. She's fantastic. And they're great commentators out there. But sometimes I do find, if I listen to commentary and they're talking about the Freudian interpretation, you know, I'd much rather be talking about sort of mint flavored dildos, you know, if it's some background information.
100%, and that's our style for sure, and that's what we love about you guys. You guys have that. Just you're able to do a little bit of the academia, but keep it.
It's great to intellectualize, but sometimes what your eyes are seeing, it's like somebody has to talk about this perm. You know what I mean? Like, exactly. We need to discuss that sandwich they're eating. Like, that's the only thing I'm thinking about. You know?
Well, I think it's important to have a bit, because otherwise you don't want to turn into Beavis and Butthead. You know, that's the other thing. That's the other extreme,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of like, you know, looking at Single White Female today, and I was sort of looking at, thinking what was really interesting was that I don't know if you remember that movie, but they were always watching.
Yeah.
Old film stars on TV, and it's that kind of artifice about watching the film stars when they presented a look. It wasn't really who they were, it was what they looked like on screen, and of course they had very flawed lives, many of them. And Bridget Fonda with her hair sort of like Mia Farrow in Rosemary's Baby, and it's kind of all the kind of things. So there's lots of interesting things going on in that. But then at the end of the movie, you have Jennifer Jason Leigh chasing Bridget Fonda with a hook in her hand, which is a move which I found out that that whole scene was added after the press the screening for the public, who said, why does she just fall out of a lift at the end? So they said they reshot this whole scene with this, like, her becoming Mrs. Voorhees in this the basement of the building. So and for me, the interesting thing of that is actually matching up and seeing how they took the toy box or the tricks from the slasher movie and put them into these high budget, high sheen psycho thrillers of the late 80s and early 90s. And of course, famously, Fatal Attraction with Glenn Close, that was a reshot to turn her into Mrs. Voorhees jumping out of the bath at the end. Glenn Close,
we just recently watched that.
Rewatched it after a long time, and just like, oh my god, it's that ending. The whole movie's incredible.
It's so perfect, and you know, the concept of her as the other woman, you know, one, her perm just brings me so much joy. Glenn Close as a like a sex symbol, you know, like seducing a married man, just like we talked about this for days afterwards, like, yeah, that is kind of like what this guy would cheat on his wife with. It's not going to be somebody who could stand up to his really like his beautiful, reserved, nurturing, perfect motherly wife. It's going to be, you know, Glenn Close.
Exactly. I think it's it's fascinating. In fact, actually, Fatal Attraction was the very first 18. I turned 18 in 1987, so that was the very first movie I saw legally at the cinema. I did see Nightmare on Elm Street and Return of the Living Dead at the cinema illegal when underage. But so that I remember the audience reaction to that movie. So I think I do think that'd be a fun thing to do because I don't think anyone else has looked at those movies. So I just thought it'd be
so amazing. Exciting. Yeah, and that hook scene when you said single white female, that's all I can, the haircut and the hook, that's it.
Yeah, and it's kind of something that was added at the end. So because in the book, I was looking at the book, which if you probably know, but Internet Archive is such an amazing resource. And it had the original SWF, the original novel. It's based on 1990. And at the end of the novel, they have the fight scene in the lift, and then the doors open, the police there, and they escort Hedra, Jennifer Jason Leigh, off, and that's it. And then so that's kind of pretty much what they shot, I think. And then the test audience says, what the fuck, you know, we want Glenn Close jumping out of the bath or whatever. So that's why they reshot the slasher movie stuff, which is kind of, for me, really interesting because of the brand audience expectations. But you do want, there's nothing worse than watching a film and going, is that it? You know, you're building up something and then it's just like, then the credits roll or whatever. You're thinking, you do feel cheated. So, yeah.
And then they were arrested.
But it's always like, whenever I watch a horror film and the killer's eyes don't open at the end, you do feel a bit cheated, don't you? Even though you know it's...
Oh, yes!
It's a huge cliche.
And you sit through the whole credits waiting for that last scene to be added on at the end, maybe, like a hand?
And it's not always.
So... possibly doing a new book. Let's talk about the first book, Teenage Wasteland. How did that come about? Was it something you proposed? Did someone come to you with the proposal? Just what's the background and just talk about putting that book together?
Well, it's a big shout out for nepotism, I think. Well, not quite nepotism. I had a friend whose partner was the commissioning editor for a publishing house and was looking for ideas for books. And she was doing a book on Lego and some bizarre things. And she said, would I be interested in developing a book on slasher movies? And I sort of said, yeah. So that's how that came about, really. It probably wouldn't have happened without that. The thing which a lot of people don't know about that book was that it originally was twice as long. And they changed it into a coffee table book about halfway through towards the end, after I'd written the book, they decided... they so loved the poster artwork, which is great, you know, loved it, but they wanted to make it the focus of the book, which meant I had to cut, it's about a third of the text out of the book to fit that in. And that was a real challenge for me because a lot of the criticism, and the book was well received mostly, but a lot of the criticism, which is completely understandable, was that some of it looked a little bit like a shopping list because it's mentioning films without talking about them, but I had to cut huge amounts. I had to fight and say, you've got to put Chucky in, because you don't put Chucky in, people are going to notice, you know. So it was a fight to keep things in and chop things out. So I was happy with how it turned out, but I've always kind of wanted to do an unabridged version of it, which was be a bit more in depth, which is kind of what I want to do with this new book, is take some of the bigger films and do 4 or 5 pages on each of them, and but then go into like the Poison Ivies, Mikey, all those kind of other films, the kind of more the straight to video or the lesser known films, some of the TV thrillers, and do kind of slightly more capsule reviews on them. But I kind of, yeah, it's something I want it to be more, have more text basically, and less pictures.
Yeah, did you supply a lot of the images for the book?
A lot of them. Some of them, it's kind of this weird kind of copyright thing, because I think you're allowed to use, in a loosest term, don't quote me on this, because I think it's a slightly kind of ambiguous, but is that you can, if a image has been produced for promotional purposes, like a movie poster or a still, and it's been sent out for promotional purposes, you can use it without permission. That is my understanding, and that's the kind of understanding of the copyright and the book. But we tried to, on the reprint, we tried to lease a photo of Jamie Lee Curtis from the first Halloween, or the new Halloween movies that came out, and it was 2007. And they wanted like $500 for this one promotional picture. So I don't know what the actual rules are on there. But yeah, for a long time I collected movie memorabilia of slasher movies. I still got a trunk of thousands, I kind of guess, of clippings, posters, press books, lobby cards from the kind of golden age slashers, and also a collected movie posters. And one of my favourite movie poster memories was with us in Italy. And we went to Rome, and I walked past the shop, and it said movie posters. I go in and I said, do you have anything by Dario Argento? And they said, oh, which film? And I sort of said, I said Mario Bava. I said, which film? And I said, oh, Shock, because I'd seen the poster of that Dario Nicoldi with a painted image of the blood on their hands, which I thought was really nice. And they came out with an armful of posters for that one film, with a Subway poster, which was the size of a wall. And so I just bought all these, what they call the Locandinas, which are the quite cheap, a Suspiria, Inferno, sort of loads of Giallo and Zombie 2. You know, I could have bought so much more. And it was such a fun experience. I spent about £100, $150 or whatever there. But so I've still got a lot of them now. And I used to buy posters, and I used to tend to, I was sort of said one of the benefits of liking films that no one else does is the memorabilia is cheap. So so on eBay, if you went to find a poster for something obscure slash movie that no one else liked, you could probably get it quite cheap. So I did, when I moved to Spain, I did sell off a lot of them, but I still have my chest full of obscure and not so obscure press books and lobby cards and stuff. So
those Subway posters are such treasures.
Yeah, it's just being able to display them. I mean, I've got like a massive poster. It used to be in this room, but we've swapped it for this kind of bizarre original painting of Marie Antoinette we found with wonky eyes. One eye's higher than the other, which we got cheap. I don't know what the provenance of it is, but had a massive poster of Spanish. I suppose it's, I don't know, it's about 2 or 3 times A1, so like a big poster, but Spanish one of Tombs of the Blind Dead, a fantastic painted one. So I've got a massive frame, so I can swap those out, and I've got a few other ones that can fit in there. But yeah, so I did love collecting them, but I kept a few back, some Happy Birthday to Me, some of the quads, the UK, it used to call the UK quads of the posters outside the cinemas, instead of the one sheets, so I've got those of Prom Night and Happy Birthday to Me and Hell Night and various things like that. So I've kept quite a lot, but I did sell, unfortunately sold quite a lot, which I regret now.
Yeah, definitely. It's tough. I mean, we're physical media people. We're surrounded by records and movies and CDs. And
it's the way to be, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We never got over it, and we still love it. When did you start actually collecting stuff? Was it just a matter of, because it was just the way, especially in the UK, like if you want to see some of these movies, you're going to have to actually get the physical and keep it. You can't just rent them. Was that, in the 90s and stuff, you just really started trading with people?
Yeah. I mean, you could, I can remember back in the early 80s when I was about 11 or 12 years old, and I went into HMV or R Price, one of the record shops here, and they had the Once Upon a Time, the Season of Banshees first compilation. They put a video of it, and it was £59 And that was in 1981.
So that's absurd.
It would have been, so all the videos back then were like between sort of £50 and £100.
I remember I worked for a video store, and I remember I would sometimes go pick up the new releases. And yeah, they were all, it was, you know, once in a while you'd have the movies that were right away, you know, being sold in stores that were regular price. But most movies for rental stores were 70, 80, 90 bucks.
It was crazy. But I mean, in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s, we used to have like what they call boot fairs, which I think in the States would be like garage sales. But like when people take their cars and open the back of their cars and sell stuff out the back on a Sunday. And you could pick up all these kind of pre-cert videos, horror videos. So ones that are being banned or, you know, so I used to collect those and find all sorts of strange and wonderful things. I found, you know, I bought them, like a blanket with three cannibal movies, pre-cert cannibal movies that had been banned, and I sold them for a couple hundred pounds. You know, I didn't particularly want to keep them, but I kind of had about 200 videos. And so, but the, sorry, that's my dog sniffing the microphone.
I love it. We love so it. Justin's dog is sniffing the microphone absolutely here for it.
Yeah, sorry, people listening, I've got a little white blind dog who's other daddy's gone away for the weekend. So she's kind of, having a bit of separation anxiety, which is why I'm holding her like a baby Jesus.
Yeah, she looks like a little angel.
She is amazing.
But yeah, I used to collect them. But the problem, I love physical media, but I think with vinyl, you can get away with something as long as you know. But with old VHS tapes, I don't know what it's like in the States.
Huge.
I used to get this tape rot. Everything would start to degrade. And I did, I've told this story before on Hysteria Continues, but it's probably bears repeating, but I used to go to New York in, was it 1999? I think in 2001, just before 9/11. And I used to go video shopping New York City and just buy everything I could and bring back a massive holdall full of tapes from the United States. And I always remember I picked up a copy of, is it Jess Franco did Oasis of the Zombies, or was that?
Yeah.
Yes, it was. So I picked that up. And it was on something called EP. It was an EP tape, which was
the weight
of a feather, because it was, the tight. But it was in Christopher Street, and I went in and bought all these movies. And I was looking at the back, and there was all these dildos hanging at the back of the store. And basically what it was a pawn shop. And because that you weren't, presumably at that time, you weren't allowed to have kind of, you would have to have a legitimate storefront. So they had all these horror movies out to as their legitimate storefront, but the main business was the porno store. So they were really pissed off that I was buying all of their kind of camouflage.
Like, wait a minute.
We have to go find new ones? Come on.
Yes, I
know. Oh, well, that's amazing.
Well, what we've recently encountered is that our old VHS won't play on our digital television because it's not like matching the rate.
Glitches out. Yeah. Oh,
so okay. Never anticipated that. So right. I guess we're going to have to get a tube television. I don't know. It's pretty crazy.
And, you know, and admittedly, we've both gotten spoiled with the restorations and stuff, and I you know,
getting things on Blu-ray and,
there, I get the nostalgia. I mean, around here there's a couple video stores where you can actually go, you know, rent a video and bring it home and bring it back the next day. That sort of nostalgia, I guess in some way it sounds great, but I can't, it's just that time has come and gone for us.
I think it's kind of that. Also, it's, so when I was watching those videos at my friend Harvey and Debs's house in my college town in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and everything would be on the 4x3 square screen. So Lucio Fulci movies, it would be, why is he so fascinated by the bridge of people's noses? And it wasn't until you actually see that you realise the zoom, it's not very forgiving if you've got all these zooms, which of course Lucio Fulci is very, very fond of. So I think it's now seeing them, but there is there was a sense of excitement about finding movies back then, which now you can go onto Shudder TV or whatever, and you can find things pretty much. But having said that, for me, again, it comes back down to finding a film like Whistle, you know, that Collywood, the Tamil language urban legend remake, which is, I think it might have been released in the United States, but probably only to Indian language video stores. But finding those still, I find exciting to come across something that's actually good or bad, but in a fun way. So there is that kind of still that kind of sense of find, you know, digging up new things, which I think is always important.
Yeah, it's just a new way of doing it now. You know, we all still do it. Get so excited to find the new things, or when the new thing comes out from Vinegar Syndrome or whatever, that I've been wanting to see that, or I actually don't know that, or. And honestly, I mean, see you guys doing a commentary on something, especially if we haven't seen it, it's like, oh, we're definitely going to get that.
See it.
You know, so we'll watch that and watch the commentary. It's great. How did you guys end up linking up with them and doing so many commentaries with them?
Well, I did. The very first commentary I did was for Arrow Video and for Slaughter High. And I kind of moderated a commentary with the director, Mark Ezra, who you know Slaughter High, the Carolyn Monroe.
Yes. Yeah.
And he was hilarious because he was telling me Dick Randall produced it. And, of course, Dick Randall did the Wild World Word of Jane Mansfield, the French Sex Murders, all these kind of crazy movies. Mark Ezra was telling me all these very salacious, gossipy stories about people involved in the movie and all sorts of things, which I can't repeat now, which is a shame because I couldn't say on the commentary. And I was saying to him, oh, so you obviously got this idea from Terror Train. He said, did I? He said, I thought I was being highly original with this. And I kept on, so I wasn't sure if I was upsetting him by kind of like, he thought he'd made his great masterpiece. And I was pointing out all these, everything he'd ripped off from. Mm-hmm. So from that we did, and then the Funhouse. Funny story, Vinegar Syndrome was starting. We ended up doing a commentary for a movie from 1978 called Savage Water. Which
unreleased.
Mahmood, if you remember Mahmood from Savage Water. And it was on a double bill with a movie called, I think, Invitation to Murder, was it? Or it was a very kind of po-faced 1970s, early 1970s American vampire movie, which wasn't in our wheelhouse at all. And we did it, and we agreed to do it, and we could find absolutely nothing about this movie at all. So we ended up having to do this kind of riff tracks thing, which wasn't what we intended to do, but we had nothing else to say about the movie. And we got the really terrible reviews from people like Tim Lucas, kind of basically wanted to, you know, would have been a much better fit for the movie. Whereas Savage Water was much more in our wheelhouse, and we had much more fun with that. So we learned our lesson not to take on near art house American vampire movies from the early 70s, especially ones you can find no information about. So that's kind of started it, and then it kind of went from there, really. I mean, it's kind of one of the things that is with commentaries or doing commentaries is that, and podcasts as well, you can't please everyone. You know, some people hate what we do, some people love it. Some people will only want a commentary with the director, even if they've got Alzheimer's and doesn't remember anything about the movie. They still would rather that over a podcast. So there is a kind of slight sense of snobbery, I think, sometimes around that, which is disappointing. But understand, we're all different, and people want different things. Some people want academic commentaries, and I kind of think that we kind of do an amalgamation of all the different things, but. You know, we tend to, you know, we have our audience, and there are obviously enough of them for people to keep asking us to do them.
But I agree, you do a nice blend of those things.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's kind of way back again, it used to be, we did a commentary for a company called 88 Films, Nelgar Massacre. We've done a newer commentary for that. And this is back with something we could never do that now, but we made an off-color joke about seagulling, which I don't know if you know what seagulling is.
But the classic seagulling joke.
Yes, so which we would never get away with now on any commentary, but they loved it. We wouldn't do that now. And sometimes, actually, for us, it's kind of we find them quite difficult. They can be quite tricky because you have to be, you can't just go off in the complete riff tracks and private jokes thing. It just doesn't work. It's not fair on people who are listening to it. So. It takes a lot more work. And I did one for Superstition, the 1982 Haunted House slasher movie, which I love. It's one of my kind of movies from growing up. But that was the first solo one I did, which is an awful lot of work. It's so much easier to do them with someone else to riff off them. Doing it on your own is torturous, put it that way. I had fun with it, but it's still torturous.
So, speaking of the podcast, how did you meet Eric? And how did that incredible relationship start, and how does it continue?
Well, I think it will probably continue sort of off into the ether. I think Eric, I think, wrote to me about Hysteria Lives as a fan, which you probably weren't like being reminded of. But we corresponded via email. I think he did some guest reviews on Hysteria Lives. So we kind of struck up a friendship through there. We did meet. We have Eric's the only person I've met in the flesh.
Right.
We were at a horror convention in Manchester, and he was being tickled by these suit men in the bar, I seem to remember. So we've kind of like just, I don't know where the Toya Susie thing came from, but it's kind of, it's just trundled on for, because I know actually funny, well, you know, some home truths here. Eric does own some Susie and the Banshees records.
There's no question in my mind. I've always said that. I said Eric definitely likes Susie, but Justin definitely does not like Toya. That's I'm 100%. I'm standing by that.
I feel so happy that now I know who Toya was. Like, Toya was never even on my radar, no, but after
it's not surprising,
looking up Toya, but after looking up Toya, like I got no problem with Toya. Toya's very fun.
She's, yeah, I mean, it's all kind of tongue in cheek, really. I mean, the thing is, growing up with Toya, it was all very kind of glee club in American terms, or sixth form panto for us. It was kind of, she was always on like children's programs doing I Want to Break Free. It's all like smash up my bedroom, teenage stuff. Mm-hmm. And she was a lot of like the punks and post punks took the piss out of her, even though she was around beginning of punk. She was in Derek Jarman's Jubilee. So, you know, she had been there at the beginning. And I appreciate the kind of inherent daftness of Toya, you know, but I'd never bought a record. But I do take great pleasure in when I find Toya records in bargain bins, of taking photos and sending it to Eric.
But that's what I like about you guys, and even the consistent jokes, because especially when you've been going for so long, that there's that, jokes do that thing, right, where it's hilarious, and then the repetition of it, it starts getting like, wait, what? But then it jumps that other level where the repetition becomes what's so funny, that you know it's coming at some point, but it you never know exactly when it's going to hit.
I mean, you should see our private signal chat we used to have.
I can only imagine.
We came off WhatsApp because we sort of dumped all the meta stuff that we could. So we went over to Signal, it's just endless memes from Eric sending me pictures of AI people in graveyards with veils on it's just like as you probably would imagine, but worse.
Oh my God.
But I think it's fun. I mean, sometimes Eric kind of, we understand where each other's levels are, I think. And Eric does play up to his anger, you know.
Of course. I never ever have once felt that there's any actual bad vibes when you guys are all making jokes. I've never once got that feeling of, oh, dude, maybe chill out a little bit. But like, it always seems to me that everyone gets and maybe part of it's even that dry, you know, British humor that you definitely have. You never laugh after you say a thing. You say it. And that's that great dry British humor.
Which comes in useful for Eric's joke of the week.
100%. I mean, it's absolutely perfect.
But now, I was just going to say, I think that the joy of that is like people, just like we've encountered in other subcultures, people who don't really have common interests, anything in common other than their common interests, right? Like, you're all very different people, very different personalities, different backgrounds, but at the same time, you're united by a common interest. And I think that's what makes interesting relationships and interesting conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think so. And also, it's like the kind of the format you have of taking a movie and talking about the, you know, the other things that are really interesting, is like talking about the honey, the honey-dipped corpses from China. So things like that are kind of... But taking a movie is a kind of is a focal point. I think it would be very difficult to a podcast where you just talked about random stuff. So actually taking a movie and using that as the focus is really important. And sometimes, I've grown to appreciate Nathan Picks. Again, it's the shot and video stuff, again, the stuff that I would not have had any interest in seeing in the 80s and the 90s particularly. you know, especially after seeing the Tom Savini The Ripper movie, which still gives me nightmares in all the wrong
that
ways.
That one, recently watched it. That one's, you know, so, I, honestly, sometimes the more professional they are, that there's a more of a dryness. Like that one, obviously, they really were making a movie and going for it. So there's almost that dryness can drag a little bit, but the finale when he's in it is pretty. It's kind of worth it for that.
Finally. Yeah, I did buy. It's one of the ones I picked up in the States with a clamshell of that. So, but I did manage to pass it on to some poor unfortunate somewhere.
Yeah. and Joseph brought on Nathan, right? Because is it the very first couple episodes or just you, Eric, and Joseph, right?
Yeah, I mean, if memory serves me well, he's Joseph thought that Nathan would be really good to talk about. Was it April Fool's Day or one of the early movies? So he fitted in, you know, really well, and I think it's kind of the magic formula. I mean, we have talked about what would happen, you know, because Eric flounces off every, you know, every couple of years. He'll have an
accent
kind of
comes on. And,
and then we do think, well, will we go on if one of us drops dead or one of us kind of decides to leave? And it's difficult to know, really, kind of like, because it has such a formula and such a camaraderie that it's difficult to replicate. Although having said that, like when we have people on like yourself and Matt Minter and people like that, it's kind of 9 times out of 10, or, you know, I don't think we've ever had a bad guest or someone, you know, we're a little worried we're going to get on somebody who's really weird and just doesn't gel. And suddenly says, I only came on here to talk about Jesus or something, you know,
right.
Do you? So, but we've never had that. So I don't know, but I think it's kind of, there is a kind of formula there. I mean, the irony actually, of course, well, not irony. I mean, it kind of, in some ways it's perfect symmetry is the slasher movie tends to be so repetitive in some ways. So in some way we're playing homage to that kind of, it's kind of what, one critic called like comfort horror, you know, and I do see that
totally.
There's a way, something about comfort horror, the idea that you can watch a movie over and over again because it gives you kind of comfort. And again, it's that if you said to somebody, I love watching movies where teenagers slashed up, people would think, I don't want to be within 100 miles of this person. But when you're watching a movie like Friday the 13th or something like that, it's not about, like you were saying, Taro, it's not about necessarily the slashing or things like that. After a while, it's about seeing, you know, like Judy in Sleepaway Camp, isn't it? You know, it's things like that. It's kind of, yes. Those are the kind of things that kind of, you know, they're more fun than some of the other things. The other things, I still kind of get a kick out of the gore gags and things like that. It's still fun.
Of course.
I just don't particularly want to be watched. I don't have the, feel the need anymore to watch a film where it's all about that or it's very dark. You know, I do kind of just want to, you know, watch Sleepaway Camp. Although I did find there was, I did post it, I think, but it was a capsule review of Sleepaway Camp, and it was something like about this is a horror film about bestiality, paedophilia, hermaphroditism, beheading, and it's kind of like, do not watch this filth, which of course it's kind of like, you know, and it's not, and when you read something like that, if you are like, you know, outraged of Omaha, you're going to be like, oh my God, this is the worst thing in the world. But you actually watch something like Sleepaway Camp. But then the other thing I love about those movies, and it's a film like The Scaremaker or Girls Night Out, they can be so cheesy all the way through, and they end, the last shot of The Scaremaker or Girls Night Out, of Ritania Alda looking out, it's got like a kind of quite a chilling effect. And the end of Sleepaway Camp is still a standout moment of something of like, what the fuck kind of horror that transcends everything else within it. And so finding those moments in movies, I think, again, is you know, a real joy.
Oh, it never ends. And Judy, of course. I bet you don't even get your bed.
Man, oh, man. Get a load of Judy.
Yeah. Man, oh, man.
Just her curling her hair in the dark. Like, oh, it's just such a joy. And then, and all equally, like, comfort horror, like Friday 5. You know? Like, as an adult, you can appreciate the just absolute bliss of all that fucking stew. Yeah.
It's, yeah, I kind of hated, I'm Friday 13 part 5. I think it's when I started Hysteria Lives, I've mentioned this quite often on the podcast. I measured everything against Halloween, My Bloody Valentine, Friday 13th part 5, Friday 13th parts 1 and 2. Everything else I measured it. So anything that wasn't up to the standards, I would kind of not review as well. I just didn't really, you know. And so Friday 13th part 5, I kind of hate it. I thought compared to part 1 and 2, it's trash. But then I became to appreciate the trash. That's the whole point of it. Danny Steinman knew what he was doing. You know, he was making a certain movie. And of course, the other thing I think sometimes people forget with these movies is they weren't made by people sitting there around stroking their chins going, oh, you know, sort of like thinking about, you know, wanting to be the next Ingmar Bergman or something. They were actually, quite often they were made with a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things,
cinematic strategy was different.
It was, yeah, exactly. And it's kind of like with Italian films, is that it's really interesting that I was reading about how the majority of the Italian genre movies were made for rural audiences. You know, there was a crossover with Dario Argento with Bird with a Crystal Plumage, and those movies with the intelligentsia and the fashionistas of Rome and Milan, right. Mm-hmm. In the same way as like Behind the Green Door or Deep Throat was, where you had that kind of porno chic crossover. The majority of them were made to appeal to a rural audience of, you know, generally not uneducated, but not as cine literate, maybe as kind of, urban audiences. So again, they were made with an artistry, but also with an eye on, you know, nudity, violence, thriller aspects, all those kind of things. A populist cinema, you know, it's a populist cinema. And I think sometimes people do lose sight of that people weren't making these films in a very po-faced way. I think they made great skill, like Dario Argento makes, you know, his early films were made with an incredible amount of skill, but also a lot of humour.
Definitely.
Think, you know, so those kind of, sometimes, I think sometimes people look back at these movies and take them too seriously in some ways.
Yeah, the giallo can get like that for sure, you know, and for us, you know, something they're just, a lot of times it's eye candy, a lot of times it's just, you know, you're looking at wallpaper, you know, in a great way. I mean, you're looking at the 70s Italian wallpaper, you're like, that's what I'm here for. I'm here for this insane wallpaper.
Again, giallo, great. That's a great genre to check out when you are on cold medicine and you're very ill.
Yeah, because you can just let it go.
Oh, there's a killer? I forgot. Okay. Yeah.
And rarely
Who's
remember.
Who's it going to be? I would have never guessed that.
Yeah.
And I certainly won't know.
Before we do let you go, you know, I do want to talk about, because, you know, we do share a love of some similar music. Mm. And want to talk about, you know, some early shows that you went to. What were some early shows that you went to back in your younger days? What did you get to see that we were way too young to get to see?
Well, there's a few standout ones. One, the very first one I saw was the band called The Mission, who you probably know.
You did see
Nazi,
so,
we love The Mission.
In 1986, I think it was, at the local university, and that was when they had a band of followers called the Eskimos, who were following around, and they'd throw shredded paper in the air. So I remember seeing that, and then fairly soon after that, I saw for the very first time Susie and the Banshees in 1987 at their concert in, it was in a park in London. It was a kind of Under Canvas, I think it was called, and they were supported by Psychic TV, Gay Bikers on Acid, Wire, and The Fall.
And so
that was the first time I'd seen any of those bands. But I do remember I saw the tallest hair I've ever seen before or since. There's a woman who had hair that was probably down to her knees. She'd backcombed it up, completely stood up, this massive hair.
Oh my God.
And of course that she wasn't that popular in this tent, because you literally couldn't see anything behind.
Can't see anything.
No, you couldn't see. So I saw them, and I saw Susie and the Banshees on the Peep Show tour after that quite a number of times, which is an amazing production, which is such a shame it never got professionally filmed, because it was an amazing production, all these seven veils dropping and these kind of, you know, her and the kind of Sally Bowles kind of Hollywood cabaret stylings. It was amazing. And I saw quite a few kind of the goth bands. I saw quite obscure bands, one called Creaming Jesus, Nosferatu, Used to go to the Slime Light in London occasionally, which was kind of like post the Batcave. And the funny story of that was it's so much dry ice. One time I was there that when the dry ice cleared, I found myself in the kitchen of this club. And I don't know how I got in there. There's so much dry ice. So who else do I see? Well, one other funny, I saw the, we went to see the Pixies, but it was their first ever gig in the UK in 1989, I think it was, at Harleston Mean Fiddler. But they came on so late, I could only stay for two songs. One of my biggest regrets. So I've seen sort of quite a few bands from around there. So we used to go up quite often to see things. I never got to see Bauhaus, unfortunately. They kind of broke up before I was old enough to go and see them. And I saw Sisters of Mercy for the first time probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And I know they're quite controversial, aren't they?
We saw them a year ago, and they played two shows like a week apart in Los Angeles, and we had tickets to the second show, and the first show, everyone who we knew went, oh, it's terrible,
unlistenable, it was so garbage, bad.
And so we were a little bit like, and I remember the day of the show, we go, you know what, no. We're not gonna go in like that. Yeah. We're going to see Sisters of Mercy. We've never seen them. Like, come on. Let's just like we just like flipped a switch in our head. Like, let's go. Let's not listen to that. And dude, they sounded awesome.
It was
like
amazing.
It was like it's
sweaty and intense. It was drum machine. Yeah.
You know, like it sounded kind of raw, but it almost sounded like the earlier stuff to us. Yeah, they do like half songs you've never heard in the set. That's a little strange, but like honestly, we were just like excited to see Sisters of Mercy. They were great. We're seeing Sisters of Mercy. Yeah. This is great.
Well, they were great when I saw them, and I heard the same things. And it was kind of lots of dry ice and stuff. It was very dramatic.
Oh yeah,
and it was I enjoyed it. I wish I'd seen them back in the day, but of course they split up in '85, didn't they? Before they came back in. For Floodlands and all the stuff which I love, but I don't know if they weren't playing live then, but I for some reason I never got to see them. I saw Fields of the Nephilim back in the day and some of those bands.
Nice.
Awesome. I was trying to think, and I saw one of my favourite ones, seeing Minty, which was a short-lived band, but with Lee Bowery. If you look him up, he's kind of really interesting guy. He's Australian. He was kind of like this kind of proto drag performer, where he was like the shape of Divine. If you look him up, you'll see he's a really interesting character. But he had a punk band called Minty. It was very kind of very interesting. So I saw lots of bands back in the day. There's a lot of quite a few holes in there. I never got to see the Smiths, which I'd have liked to. But
it would have been amazing. The mission, would that have been on like when they're doing like Severina and Wasteland?
It was Wasteland. It was around that time. Yeah. It was around the time of the first God's Own Medicine? I think it was the first
God's
album.
Own Medicine, yeah.
Yeah. So it was just when they started out, because I know it was in Sisters of Mercy, and there's a great video for Black Planet, I think Sisters of Mercy one, where Wayne Hussey's in the back of that car driving along the California highway.
Yep.
It was like a sort of 1960s kind of car, and Wayne Hussey's asleep.
It's the monkey's car, I'm pretty sure.
The monkey's car, is it? Okay,
I'm pretty sure it is actually, if it's not, and they're just driving around. And then that great, the Sisters of Mercy Wake live at Royal Albert Hall was like, I think their last show of that lineup.
Yes, that was '85, wasn't it? I do have it on VHS, yeah.
We still do, and there's so much smoke on stage, so much dry ice on stage that there's no way that they can see each other.
Yeah.
Like Eldred's just in the middle. And I mean, they hated each other, I think, too. Yeah. So I'm sure that was by design.
That's probably by design.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like you guys. So you don't look at each other. Like,
well, exactly.
You can just like,
hear about bands taking different tour buses. It's similar to that, isn't it? So, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see Bauhaus in reunion times at all?
No, I didn't. No, it was a shame. I'd like to, but I can't remember why. I mean, I did see the ones, I saw the concert online, like the New York one where he comes down like a bat upside down, which was great. Because I always thought, for me, again, a lot of the time, it was interesting because a lot of people... growing up as the goth subculture, I kind of came to it not that late, because I guess it was 85, 86, because it was the Cult that I kind of got me into it. Susan the Banshees and the Cult in about 85 kind of got me into it. But it was, there was a lot of humor in the kind of UK goth scene. It was kind of quite, there was a lot of po-faced, people were very po-faced, but we used to just drink Snakebite and Black and hang out in graveyards and laugh. You know, that was kind of what it was. And there was also quite a lot of humor in a lot of the goth music. Like Andrew Eldridge is quite funny. Wayne Hussey is pretty funny. Oh, yeah. I'm not sure Pete Murphy probably takes himself quite seriously, but you know, but Susan and Banshees were, you know, pretty playful. So there was kind of
Robert Smith, of course.
Yeah.
Well, Justin, this is so much fun. Thank you for taking the time to do this.
That was a pleasure. That was a lot of fun.
Such a fun
conversation. Again, for anyone listening, Hysteria continues. I mean, we're in year 13, year 14, year.
With 2011, we started.
So we're in year 14. We're in it.
Yeah. Wow.
And, you know, consistent. The Patreon's incredible because you get a bunch of extra stuff. You get a monthly commentary, which I won't spoil because I know you guys do it as at the end of the previous commentary. But for June, anyone who knows us, there's a movie. I might be on that commentary, and some people may say that it was the guest spot that I was meant for a podcast. So that's all I'll say about that.
Yes, but it's going to be epic in more ways than one.
It is absolutely going to be. But already announced is the May commentary is going to be Bloody Moon. So last episode of ours is Bloody Moon. Commentary coming up, Bloody Moon. So it's such a great, and the commentaries are great because you can just listen to them. Actually, it's kind of half and half. Sometimes I just listen to it like it's a podcast.
Sometimes
like,
watch along. Sometimes
We just, it just depends if we're like driving or something. We're like, oh, just throw it on because, you know, it's so you can don't even feel that you have to watch it as a commentary. I think it works as a podcast.
No obligation.
No obligation. Well, I think for there's an, I hate dead noise on commentaries. We did, just as a quick aside, but when we did some of the Vinegar Syndrome things, we had we did Titan Find, the Klaus Kinski movie, aka Creature, and people were going, why is there so much dead air? But they actually, any movie that's owned by MGM, they are completely censorious. They just cut everything, anything out that they think might be libelous. And when they say libelous, they cut anything about Klaus Kinski in case his ghost sued them, presumably.
So insane.
So it's bizarre. So anything that's, well, you know, written about by in books by his daughter. We didn't even go into the really salacious stuff. It was just kind of stuff that's on the other commentaries about one of the actresses saying he tried to grope her and he was a bit of a lech on set and things like that. You know, it's all stuff that's all been written about elsewhere. All, everything
that's well documented.
It, well documented. It all got cut out. Yeah. Absolutely, all of it, which makes it sound like we just stopped talking. And for me, that's a bit a bugbear of mine. It's like when I listen to Andrew Davis's commentary for The Final Terror, where he just stops talking for 5 minutes and then goes, "Oh, I go on holiday there and things like that." I'm just thinking, I want to hear people talking about the movie, and if they stop talking, I'm just, so that's why I think that I agree. They work as podcasts because we never shut up.
So. And I hope you never do shut up. I hope you never stop the Toy versus Susie. I still am sad we don't get the Carry On drops because those still, to me, I will say them to each other all the time. But you
I'm
know,
singing the cat flushing a toilet song in my head right now.
Yeah, yeah, that kind of tired. I feel like
I know. Back at some point, I need to get around to getting a few more of those. Some jokes bear repeating, but they might be good, might be fun to resurrect a few of them.
Some jokes aren't funny, not only anymore, but just not funny. Speaking of Eric's joke of the week, In fact, we really do. I really look forward to all of every joke of the week. Mm-hmm. Look forward to every episode. So, gotta get on the Hysteria Continues. Gotta get on the Patreon for the Hysteria Continues. Justin, thank you so much. More years of the Hysteria Continues.
Fantastic. Excellent. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It's been like speaking with old friends. So thank you. And enjoying the podcast and keep doing what you're doing too.
We absolutely will. All right. We will talk to you soon. Thanks so much, Justin.
Thank you.